sparingly he sprinkled a little barley in his bowl, dropped in a small pat of butter, and then held out the bowl for the young monk to fill it up with tea. "This is more luxury than I have had in more than 60 years, he exclaimed. "I think I can be forgiven for having something hot after all these years. I could never manage a fire alone, tried it just once and set my robe on fire. Yes, I have a few scars on my body from those flames, but they healed. Took many weeks, but they healed. Oh well, that comes of trying to pamper oneself." He sighed heavily, and sipped the tea. "You have one advantage, venerable one," laughed the young monk. "Light and dark mean nothing to you. In this darkness I have just upset my teeth through not being able to see it." "Oh!" exclaimed the old man, "here, have mine." "No, no, venerable one," replied the young man affectionately, "we have plenty. I will just pour myself some more." For a time they sat in companionable silence until the tea was all gone, then the young monk rose to his feet and said, "I will now go and get more water and firewood. May I take your bowl that I may clean it?" Into the now empty waterkin went the two bowls as the younger man made his way out of the cave. The old hermit sat erect, waiting, just waiting as he had waited for many decades past. The sun had now set. Only the upper peaks of the mountains were still bathed in golden light, light which turned to purple even as the young monk watched. Deep in the shadowed flanks of the mountain range small specks of light appeared one by one. The butter lamps of far distant lamaseries gleaming through the cold clear air of the plain of Lhasa. The shadowed outline of Drepung Lamaserie loomed like a walled city lower down the valley. Here, on the mountainside itself, the young man could look out over the city, the lamaseries, and watch the gleaming happy river. Far away on the other side the Potala and Iron Mountain were still imposing in spite of the apparent diminution of size through the great distance. But there was no time to waste. The young monk scolded himself in shocked surprise at his dilatoriness and hastened off along the darkening path to the edge of the lake. Quickly he washed and scoured the two bowls and the water can. Hastily he scooped the can full of clean water and set off along the path back, dragging with him the large branch which previously he had been too laden to handle. Stopping for a moment to regain his breath, for the branch was very large and heavy, he looked back towards the mountain pass leading to India. There glowed a farther flickering light which must denote a caravan of traders encamped for the night. No trader ever travelled by night. The young man's heart leapt. Tomorrow the traders would wend their slow way along the mountain trail and would no doubt make their camp at the lakeside before going on to Lhasa the day after. Tea. Butter. The young man grinned to himself and took up his burden renewed. "Venerable one," he called as he entered the cave with the water. "There are traders on the pass. Tomorrow we may have butter, sugar. I will keep close watch for them." The old man chuckled as he remarked, "Yes, but for now, we sleep." The young man helped him to his feet and placed his hand on the wall. Shakily he went off to the inner compartment. The young monk lay down and scooped the depression for his hip bone. For some time he lay there thinking of all that he had heard. Was it true that humans were weeds? Just experimental animals? No, he thought, some of us are doing our best in very difficult circumstances and our hardships were to encourage us to do better and climb upwards, for there is always room at the top. So thinking, he fell into a sound sleep. Chapter 7. The young monk turned over and shivered. Sleepily he rubbed his eyes and sat up. The entrance to the cave was a dim grey blur against the blackness of the interior. There was a sharp sting to the air. Quickly the young man put his robe about him and hastened to the entrance. Here the air was cold indeed, with the wind moaning through the trees and making the leaves rustle. Small birds nestled close to the trunks on the lee side. The surface of the lake was roiled and turbulent, with wind-driven waves pounding against the banks and making the reeds bow down in protest against the force. The newborn day was grey and troubled. Sweeping black clouds billowed over the mountain ridge and swept down the slopes like sheep being hounded along by the dogs of heaven. The mountain passes became hidden in clouds as black as the rock itself. Still the clouds came swooping down, obliterating the countryside, drowning the plain of Lhasa in a sea of rolling fog. A sudden gust of wind, and the cloud formation swept over the young monk. So thick it was that he could no longer see the cave entrance. Nor could he see his hand placed before his face. Slightly to the left of where he stood the fire hissed and spat eared as the moisture drops fell upon it. Hastily he broke sticks and piled them upon the still glowing fire and blew that the sticks would the more easily ignite. The damp wood spat and smoked and was long in waking to flame. The moaning of the wind rose to a shriek. The cloud became thicker and the violent pounding of hailstones drove the young monk to cover. The fire hissed and slowly died. Before it was quite extinguished, the young man dashed out and seized a branch which was still aflame. Quickly he dragged it to the mouth of the cave where it was sheltered from the worst of the storm. Unhappily he dashed out again to rescue as much of the firewood as possible, firewood that now was streaming with water. For a time he stood panting after his efforts, then removing his robe he wrung it out, expelling most of the water. Now the fog was invading the cave and the young man had to feel his way in by holding onto the rock wall. Cautiously he made his way further in until at last he collided with the great rock beneath which he was wont to sleep. "What is it?" queried the voice of the old hermit. "Do not worry, venerable one," replied the young man soothingly, "the clouds have descended and our fire is all but extinguished." "Never mind," said the old man philosophically, "there was water before there was tea. Let us therefore drink water and postpone tea and sampa until the fire permits." "Yes, venerable one," responded the younger man, "I will see if I can rekindle the fire beneath the overhanging rock. I saved a burning branch for that purpose." He made his way out to the entrance. Hailstones were falling in torrents. The whole ground was covered with ice pebbles and the gloom was even more intense. There came a whip-like crack followed by the deep rumble of thunder, a rumble which echoed and re-echoed around the wide valley. From nearby came the slithering of falling rocks and the ground shook as they made their impact upon the mountain base. One of the frequent rockfalls, started by the vibration of the thunder or perhaps a great rock, had been split by the lightning. The young man wondered if any other hermitage had been swept aside like a feather in a gale. For a time he stood there listening, wondering if he would hear a call for help. At last he turned away and stooped over the glowing branch. Carefully he broke small pieces of twig and fed the flames anew. Dense clouds of smoke arose and were blown valleywards by the storm, but the flames, sheltered by the rocky outcrop, grew apace. In the cave the old hermit was shivering as the chill, wet air seeped through his thin and tattered robe. The young monk felt his blanket, and the two was saturated. Taking the old man by the hand he led him slowly to the cave entrance and bade him sit. The younger man carefully pulled the flaming branches closer so that the old one could feel the heat and be cheered. "I will make some tea," he said, "we now have enough fire." So saying, he hurried back into the cave for the water can, and soon returned with it and the barley. "I will tip out half the water," he said, "then we shall not have so long to wait and anyway the fire is a little small for a full can." Side by side they sat, protected from the worst onslaughts of the elements by the rocky overhang and by the side outcropping. The cloud was thick and no bird sang nor moved. "There will be a very hard winter," exclaimed the old hermit. "I am fortunate that I shall not have to endure it. When I have given all my knowledge to you I can lay down my life and shall be free to depart to the heavenly fields where once again I shall be able to see." He mused in silence for a moment while the young monk watched the slow steam form on the surface of the water, then he continued, "It is hard indeed to wait all these years in total blackness, with no man to call friend, to live alone in such poverty that even warm water seems a luxury. The ages have dragged by and I have spent a long life here in this cave, journeying no further from it than I have now journeyed to this fire. For so long have I been silent that even my voice comes forth in a veritable croak. Until you came I have had no fire, no warmth, no companionship during the storms when the thunder shook the mountains and the rocks came tumbling down, threatening to wall me in. The young man rose and wrapped the fire-dried blanket around his elder's thin shoulders and then turned back to the water can, the contents of which were now bubbling merrily. Into the can went a generous lump of tea brick. The bubbling ceased as the cold particles brought the water below the boiling point. Soon the steam rose again and into the water went the borax and the last of the sugar. The newly peeled stick was brought into energetic use, and a flat piece served as a scoop to remove the worst of the twigs and debris from the surface. Tibetan tea, China tea, is the very cheapest form of tea, consisting of floor sweepings from the better grades. It is the residue left after the women have picked the plants of all the choice leaves and thrown aside the dust. The whole is compressed into blocks, or bricks, and carried over the mountain passes to Tibet where Tibetans, who can afford nothing better, obtain the bricks by barter and use it as one of the staples of their hard existence. Borax is a necessary additive as the raw tea is so crude and rough that stomach cramps are frequent. A definite part of the ritual of tea making consists of scraping the surface clear of debris. "Venerable one," asked the young monk, "have you never been to the lake? Never wandered up to that large stone slab to the right of this cave?" "No," replied the hermit, "since I was brought into this cave by the men from space I have never been further away from it than this point where we now sit. Why should I? I cannot see what there is about me, I cannot travel with safety to the lake, for I might fall in. After the long years in the cave, in darkness, I find that the rays of the sun are troublesome to my flesh. When first I came here I used to feel my way to this point and be warmed by the sunlight, but now for many a long year one have remained inside. What is the weather like now?"
"Bad, venerable one," replied the young monk. "I can see our fire, I can see the faintest outline of a rock beyond. All else is blanketed by this greasy grey fog. The storm clouds from the mountain, a storm from India." Idly he examined his nails, very long they were. Uncomfortably so. Casting about he found a strip of rotten stone, burned rock flung out of the mountain by some volcanic upheaval ages ago. Energetically he rubbed the slip of rock against the nail of each finger until it was worn down to a suitable length. Toenails too, they were thick and hard. But far too long. Resignedly he hoisted up one foot and then the other until at last he had all his nails trimmed to his satisfaction. "You cannot see any pass?" queried the old man. "Are the traders fog-bound in the mountains?"
"They most certainly are," exclaimed the young man. "They will be telling their beads, in the hope of keeping the devils away. We shall not see the traders this day, or night, until the fog lifts. And even then the ground is covered with frozen hail LTs thick here."
"Well, then," answered the old one, "we should get on with our talk. Is there any more tea?"
"Yes, there is," replied the young monk. "I will fill your bowl but you must drink it quickly, for it is cooling rapidly. Here it is. I will put on some more wood." He paused to place the bowl in the old man's outstretched hands, and rose to throw more wood on the cheering fire. "I will fetch some more of the wood from out of the rain," he called, moving into the thick fog. Soon he returned dragging branches and twigs which he placed around the perimeter of the fire. Proximity to that heat would soon cause the steam to rise and the wood to dry.
"Well, venerable one," he said, seating himself near the old man, "I'm ready to listen when you are ready to speak."
For some minutes the old man remained silent, probably reliving in his mind those long past days. "It is strange," he remarked eventually, "to sit here as the poorest of the poor, as one poor even among the poor, and to contemplate the wonders which I have witnessed. I have experienced much, seen much, and been promised much.
the keeper of the heavenly fields is almost ready to welcome me in. One thing I have learned, and you will do well to remember it in the years ahead, is this life is the shadow life. If we do our tasks in this life, we shall go to the real life hereafter. I know that, for I have seen it. But now let us continue with that which I am charged to tell you. Where was I? He hesitated and stopped for a moment. The young monk took the opportunity to throw more wood on the fire. Then the hermit spoke again. Yes, the air of tension in that rock chamber grew and grew, and I was the most tense of all. Reasonably so, for all the risk was to me. At last, when the tension had reached an almost unbearable point, the admiral uttered a cult command. There was a movement of some technician near my head and a sudden click. Immediately I felt all the pains of hell surge through my body. It seemed that I was swelling and was about to burst. Jagged lightning flashed across my brain, and my empty eye sockets felt as though filled with glowing coals. There was an intolerable wrenching, a sharp, painful snap, and I went spinning and whirling through, I felt, all eternity. Crashes, bangs, and horrendous noises accompanied me. Down and down I fell, spinning and tumbling head over heels. Then I felt as though I were in a long black tube of woolly, clinging material, and at the top of the tube the rapiered a blood-red glow. Now the spinning ceased, and I began a slow ascent towards the glow. Sometimes I slid back, sometimes I halted, but always a terrible, inexorable pressure drove me on again, painfully, hesitantly, but always upward. At last I reached the source of the blood-red glow and could go no further. A skin, or membrane, or something obstructed my passage forward. Again and again I was forced against the obstacle. Again and again I was prevented from proceeding. The pain and the terror increased. A violent surge of pain and a terrific force behind me slammed me again and again against the barrier. There was a screaming, ripping sound, and I was propelled at vast velocity through the crumbling barrier. Upwards I sped until my consciousness dimmed and was extinguished by the appalling shock. There was a fading impression of falling. In my brain a voice was dinning, "Get up, get up." Wave after wave of nausea engulfed me. Ever that forceful voice exhorted, "Get up, get up." At last, in sheer desperation, I forced open my eyes and stumbled to my feet. But no. I had no body, I was a disembodied spirit free to roam anywhere on this world. This world? What was this world? I looked about me and the strangeness of the scene grew upon me. The colors were all wrong. The grass was red and the rocks were yellow. The sky was of a greenish cast and there were two suns. One was blue-white and the other orange. The shadows. There is no way in which to describe the shadows cast by two suns. But worse, stars were showing in the sky. In daylight. There were stars of all colors. Reds, blues, greens, amber, and even white. Nor were they scattered as were the stars to which I was accustomed. Here the sky was covered with these stars as the ground is covered with stones. From afar came noise, sounds. By no stretch of imagination could I call those sounds music, yet I had no doubt that it was music. The voice came again, cold and implacable, "Move, will yourself where you want to go." So I thought of floating to the spot from whence there came the sounds, and I was there. On a level patch of red grass, with the purple and orange trees fringing the edge, there danced a group of young people. Some were clad in garments of startling hues, others were not clad at all. Yet these latter excited no comment. Off to one side others sat on seats on legs and played instruments which it is quite beyond my ability to describe. The noise they made is even more impossible of description. All the tones seemed to be wrong, and the beat had no meaning to me. "Go among them," commanded the voice. It suddenly occurred to me that I was floating above them. So I willed myself to a clear patch of grass and thought myself upon it. It was hot to the touch and I feared that my feet would scorch, until I remembered that I had none and was but a disembodied spirit. The latter was soon made apparent to me, a naked young female chasing a garishly clad young man ran right through me and neither of us felt a thing. The young female caught a man and linking her arms with his, led him off behind the purple trees from the locality of which there came many screams and shouts of joy. The users of musical instruments went on misusing them, and everyone seemed to be remarkably content. I rose upon the air quite without my own volition. I was directed as is a kite directed by the boy who holds the string. Higher and higher I rose until afar I could discern the glint of water, or was it water? The color was a pale lavender which gave off flashes of gold from wave crests. The experiment had killed me, I decided, I am in limbo, in the land of the forgotten people. No world could have such colors, such strange things. No, muttered that inexorable voice in my brain, the experiment was a success. You will have a commentary now on all that happens that you may be the better informed. It is vital that you comprehend all that is shown you. Pay great attention. Pay great attention, could I do aught else? I wondered ruefully. I rose higher and higher. From afar came the glitter of burning gleams upon the skyline. Strange and fearsome shapes stood there, like devils at the portals of hell. Faintly I could discern bright spots which dipped and rose and shot from shape to shape. And all around there were vast roadways which radiated away from those shapes as the petals of a flower radiate away from its center. All this was a mystery to me. I could not imagine the nature of that which I saw and could but float there amazed. Abruptly I found myself jerked into motion again and with increasing speed. My altitude lessened. I descended, quite involuntarily, to a point where I could discern individual homes dotted along each of the radiating roadways. Each home seemed to me to be at least the size of those of the highest nobles of Lhasa, each contained within a quite sizable plot of ground. Strange metal things lumbered across the fields doing those things which only a farmer could describe. But then, as I was brought much lower, I discovered a very large estate which consisted mainly of shallow water in which there were perforated benches. Wondrous plants were resting upon the benches, and their roots trailed in the water. The beauty and size of these plants were immeasurably greater than those growing in the soil. I gazed, and wondered at these marvels. Again I was lofted to whence I could see far ahead. The shapes which had so intrigued me from afar were now much closer, but my bemused brain was not able to comprehend that which I saw. It was too stupendous, too utterly incredible. I was a poor native of Tibet, just a humble priest who had never been further abroad than one short visit to Kalimpong. Yet here before my astonished eyes, did I have eyes, loomed a great city, a fabulous city. Immense spires soared perhaps 1,800 feet into the air. Each spire, or tower, was bearmed with a spiral balcony from each of which radiated slender, unsupported roadways joining the whole into a web more intricate than that spun by spiders. The roadways were thronged with speeding traffic. Above and below fluttered mechanical birds laden with people, each avoiding all others with a skill which filled me with the utmost admiration. A speeding mechanical bird came upon me. I saw a man in the front staring but seeing me not. My whole body contracted and writhed with fear at thought of the impending collision, yet the contraption sped on, through me, and I felt it not. What was I? Yes, I remembered, I was now a disembodied spirit, but I wished someone would tell my brain that for I experienced every emotion, and principally fear, that a normal complete body would have experienced. I loitered among those spires and dangled over the roadway. And I discovered new marvels. Certain high levels had stupendous hanging gardens. Incredible playgrounds for what were obviously nobles. But the colors were all wrong. The people were all wrong. Some were vast giants and others were dwarfs. Some were definitely human and others very definitely were not. Some, indeed, were a strange mixture of humanoid and avian, with the body seemingly of human construction, yet possessing a definitely bird-like head. Some were white, Some were black. Some were red, while other were green. There were all colors, not merely hues and tints, but definite, primary colors. Some had four fingers and a thumb on each hand, yet others had nine fingers and two thumbs on each hand. And one group had three fingers, horns extending from the temples and tail. My nerve broke at the latter sight and I willed myself up, fast. From my new altitude the city clearly covered an immense area, it extended as far as I could see, but at one distant side there appeared a clearing which was free of tall buildings. Here the air traffic was intense. Shining dots, for so they appeared from this distance, soared with eye-baffling velocity in a horizontal plane. I found myself drifting towards that district. As I approached, I discovered that the whole area seemed to be made of glass, and upon its surface there were strange metal craft. Some were spherical in form and seemed from their direction of travel to journey beyond the confines of this world. Others, like two metal bowls stuck rim to rim, also appeared to be for out-of-world travel. Yet others were like the spear that is thrown, and I observed that these, after rising to a predetermined height, then became horizontal and journeyed to an unknown place upon the surface. There was stupendous movement and I could scarce believe that all these people could be contained within one city. All the inhabitants of the world were congregated here, I thought. But where was I? I felt panic rise. The voice answered me saying, "You must understand that the earth is a small place. The earth is as one of the smallest grains of sand upon the banks of the Happy River. The other worlds of this universe in which your earth is located are as numerous and as diverse as the sand, the stones, and the rocks which line the banks of the Happy River. But this is just one universe. There are universes beyond number just as there are blades of grass beyond number. Time upon earth is just a flickering in the consciousness of cosmic time. Distances upon earth are of no moment, they are insignificant and do not exist compared to the greater distances in space. Now you are upon a world in a far, far different universe, a universe so remote from the earth which you know that it would be beyond your comprehension. The time will come when the greatest scientists of your world will have to admit that there are other worlds inhabited, and that Earth is not, as they now believe, the center of creation. You are now upon the chief world of a group numbering more than 1,000. Each of those worlds is inhabited, each of those worlds owe allegiance to the master of the world where you now are. Each world is entirely self-governing, although they all follow a common policy. A policy aimed at removing the worst injustices under which people live. A policy devoted to improving conditions of all who have life. Each world has a different sort of person upon it. Some are small as you have seen, some are large as you have also seen. Some, by your standards, are grotesque and fantastic, others are beautiful, angelic you might say. One should never be deceived by outward appearances, for the intention of all is good. These people owe allegiance to the master of the world upon which you now are. It would be useless and a strain to your intelligence to try to give to you names because the names would have no meaning in your own tongue, in your own comprehension, and would merely serve to confuse you. These people owe allegiance, as I have said, to the great master of that world, one who has no territorial desires whatever. One whose main interest is in the preservation of peace, peace so that all man no matter his shape, his size or his color may live out the days allotted to him and devote himself to good instead of the destruction which will ensue whenever a person has to defend himself. Here there are no great armies, there are no battling hordes. There are scientists, traders, and of course priests, and there are also explorers. Those who go out to remote worlds ever increasing the number of those who join this mighty fellowship. But none are invited to join. Those who join this federation do so at their own request and only when they have destroyed weapons. The world upon which you now are is the center of this particular universe. It is the center of culture, the center of knowledge and there is none greater. A special form of travel has been discovered and developed. Here again to explain such methods would be to overtax the brains of the greatest scientists of the earth. They have not yet reached the stage of thinking in four- and five-dimensional concepts, and such a discussion would be gibberish to them until they can rid their minds of all those beliefs which have so long held them captive. The scenes you now see are the leading world as it is today.